This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. When they taught state legislators how to draw, they evidently didn't stress staying inside the line. So when they met in Raleigh this week to comply with a court order to change the makeup of the state's 1st and 12th districts, they rearranged the lines in almost every district in the state. South Carolina is getting ready for tomorrow and the second presidential primary in the country. The Charlotte Observer discovered big racial disparities in marijuana arrests by CMPD among African Americans, other minorities, and whites. Concerns are increasing among parents about CMS pupil reassignment. And could there be lead in our drinking water? Those and other stories will be the focus of our weekly regional news roundup this hour. WFAE's Tom Bullock is here along with Mary Newsom, Associate Director of the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute and the person in charge of PlanCharlotte.org. We're also joined by Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, and for the first time, Hillary Burns, staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. Welcome to you all, and particularly to you, Hillary. Welcome to the Den of Thieves. Nice to have you here. Get a little closer to that microphone, if you would. Last week, when we spoke on this program about redistricting in North Carolina as a result of that federal court finding that two of the congressional districts were unconstitutional because they were based on racial makeup of the population, someone on this panel said that it was doubtful lawmakers would do anything until a higher court ruled. Well, what a difference a week makes. The March primary looming large, and the legislators got to work and redrew the entire map. What happened?
Well, to be fair, I did make that comment.
I didn't name any names here.
I said, I hope that I'm wrong, and I was, without a doubt, wrong. This week has been a blur when it comes to this map. Obviously, they were plugging along and using computer programs to actually get this thing going long before they said anything. But they clearly want to meet with a court-mandated deadline of later today to make sure this thing is done. Here's where we stand. The map is a significant change. If it is approved, it significantly changes 12 of the 13 congressional districts in North Carolina. The 13th, which is way, way out west, it still changes, just not as significantly as the others. Now, the House has already voted to approve basically a new timeline for elections. The Senate approved the map. Today they're going to flip-flop and approve what the other has already approved. All of it is expected to go through today. And everybody, including congressional candidates, are scratching their heads going, huh?
Well, the immediate reaction on, I think, what was it, Monday or Tuesday, everybody was stunned by this. Why did they have to do it to such a great degree? You have the map in front of you, Mary. Why did they have to change everything almost? Everything changes.
Well, I think they had to because everything is connected to everything else. If you tweak one congressional, or let's be more precise, if you tweak the 9th, the 12th, you have to tweak the 9th. If you tweak the 1st, you have to tweak all the ones around it. And that's what they did. They ended up kind of dispossessing the current representative in the 12th district, Alma Adams, who lives in Greensboro. The 12th district that they drew is now entirely in Mecklenburg County, I believe. And they also kind of dispossessed the 13th district rep, George Holding, who lives in Wake County. And that district, which snaked around the middle of the state, it's now kind of the northern Piedmont area, you know, Iredell.
It shifted 100 miles west.
Yeah, and he doesn't live there.
But Alma Adams does, which is one of the ironic things about this map.
Oh, does she lives in
She now lives
in the 13th district. Well, yeah. And as many people probably don't realize, the Constitution does not require a congressional representative to live in the district that he or she represents.
Now, you know, here's the thing. I agree with Mary that obviously the 1st and the 12th, which are the two districts that were ordered by the judges to be redrawn, they're very oddly shaped, and they do touch about half of the other congressional districts in the state. The 1st has been compared to an octopus. The 12th, it is a snake. I mean, it literally kind of slithers its way from Charlotte up I-85 to Greensboro, actually north of Greensboro and Winston-Salem. But what I was surprised by, and what a lot of people I think were surprised by, is the state legislature could have nipped here and tucked there and kind of, you know, readjusted the problems that the federal panel pointed out. They didn't do that. This is almost completely a redraw. It is almost completely changing districts that really didn't need to be changed according to the judges.
One of the interesting things that David Lewis, the state legislator, has said is that they decided to not look at race at all, which could either be a kind of in-your-face move to the Justice Department, or it could be a looky here, here's what happens when we don't consider race.
I totally took it as a slap in the face to the three-judge panel that struck down the maps. The judges said you relied too much on race in drawing the 2011 maps. The Republicans in Raleigh said, okay, fine. We just won't consider it at all. And we'll do it strictly. And they made it so plain that they were doing this on a partisan basis. We drew these maps to retain a 10-3 partisan advantage. And they did it to such an aggressive extent that it does make you wonder if they're almost challenging the Supreme Court
explain to me,
do something about partisan, districts.
Sorry. Explain to me why it is unconstitutional to take race into consideration, but it is not unconstitutional to take political affiliation.
It's not unconstitutional to take race into consideration. This gets back to the Voting Rights Act, which is so complex that anything I say about it, I'll probably be wrong. But the Supreme Court has ruled that it's okay to take politics into consideration. And the Supreme Court is trying to figure out to what extent can you take race into consideration. I believe as it stands now, you can't have race be your defining consideration, but it can be one of a number of considerations.
I know it sounds crazy, but partisan gerrymandering is not just constitutional. It was the state's defense in this case. It is 100% absolutely A-OK according to the law. Now, when it comes to race, it is really tricky, and this is where you get into terms when it comes to the Voting Rights Act, like packing and cracking. Cracking is when you take a district and separate out minority voters so that way their votes are diluted. Packing is when you pack them all into a district, but that could also dilute their overall representation because they get one congressperson instead of potentially more. So it is really complicated, and what it boils down to, and this is something actually that critics of this panel have pointed out, which is okay. So which is it? We're supposed to make sure that that minorities have representation in Congress, but we're not supposed to use minorities to set up districts, except where the Voting Rights Act says we must. So it is very, very complicated. But there's one other point I want to make on this, which is also just because you don't take demographic data into consideration when you're making these districts doesn't mean you're not taking race into consideration. Sure. African Americans vote predominantly for Democrats. So when you're going by voting record on how people voted for governor, for senator, for all these other positions that they use, you still are using race, just not directly.
So the 12th congressional district, as it was drawn originally, is a primarily Democratic district. Is it also primarily African American?
I think it's
less than a majority now.
It's pretty close.
But it's 51% Democratic, I think, in terms of how the precincts have voted in the past.
In fact, not to defend the 12th district because it just looked ridiculous, but it was originally drawn under, I believe, a Democratic legislature, and the point of it was to try to elect a minority candidate.
And it's also important to note the U.S. Justice Department approved the current map with all of the crazy animal-like districts back in 2011, was first drawn. Yeah. So it is one of the things that Republican lawmakers are pointing to, and they should. This map was approved by the Justice Department.
Just on, from an average bystander on the street who walks by and maybe gets told all of this and is trying to understand it, it's got to be extremely confusing because you've got courts saying on the one hand, but on the other hand, and you've got – it's just – very confusing.
So the 12th district now will go from being this snake that is sometimes about as wide as an interstate highway in some places that goes from Charlotte to Greensboro and beyond to something that's completely contained within Mecklenburg County. And it's northern and western Mecklenburg County. What does that do to the makeup of the voting block in that district? Is it Democratic? Is it mixed? Is it Republican? What is it?
I think it's predominantly Democratic.
I think it makes it more Republican than it was before, just because North Mecklenburg County is more Republican than a lot of the urban areas.
Will their votes be diluted by the western parts of the county, which may be African American?
What do you mean diluted?
Well, in other words, they had power before. Now they're mixed in with a greater population of people who are tending to vote Democratic. Will they be – would their votes count as much?
Their votes are – look, the 12th – Representative Lewis came straight out and said the 12th is going to be really hard for a Republican to win. It has more Republicans, but it is a blue district. And yeah, for Republicans in North Mac, when places like, you know, Huntersville and Cornelius – their votes basically now are, you know, I don't want to say they don't count. They won't get lost. They get the same say in the process they had before, but they don't have the same influence at all.
Yeah. Well, I think, Mike, you've kind of hit on one of the things that has made a lot of people uneasy about any of this, which is that if you're a Republican in a district that was drawn to elect a Democrat, or if you're a Democrat in a district that was drawn to elect a Republican, you can feel disenfranchised. If you're in the 9th district now, which we are, I don't know that there's even a Democrat running. There's a Republican running against Representative Pittenger.
Could that change now that the districts have been redrawn? Could a Democrat step up?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the Republican running against Representative Pittenger doesn't even live in the new district.
No,
if
he
this
doesn't.
District is
he
accepted.
Does not.
Yeah.
And that's actually a common problem through a lot of these places. Again, we talked about the 13th. You know, shifting 100 miles west. Well, obviously, the current representative doesn't live there.
And his constituents don't know him.
Have no idea. Yeah. Now, here's what happens. Because of all of this, we're going to have a new filing period that is going to be set up from, what is it, March 25th, I think, for a week. So candidates can now re-enter and officially rerun. We're going to have a new primary date, which is going to be June 7th. So now North Carolina has two primaries, March 15th for absolutely everything but the congressional elections, which will be on June 7th. Now, here's where it gets really confusing and so much fun to cover as a political reporter. The current candidates for Congress will continue to campaign for a March 15th primary because at any point the Supreme Court may or may not issue a stay. However, that all of that may be for naught because if the current map or the new proposed maps have to go into place, they're really going to be campaigning for a June 7th primary. Their names will still be on the ballots, but that may or may not be an actual election because we don't know what's going to happen. And here's where it gets even more fun. They are now saying that there will be no runoffs in the state. Now, current law requires you need to get more than 40% of the vote to not have a runoff. So we're going to have a plurality now, a lower standard for some races where let's take, you know, the U.S. The primary for U.S. Senate for the Democrats. You have four candidates who are largely not known outside of their home bases, and one of them could just win outright with a really low vote get. And if all of this wasn't fun enough, because of the second filing deadline, candidates can run for one thing in March 15th primary, then run for Congress on the June 7th primary, and then they get a pick which one they want to go for the general election. So
you can't help but wonder who specifically was that written in for, because it was written for somebody. You have to think.
Yeah, no, I would agree, but it's going to be a bumpy ride.
How much of the rush to make this decision had to do with the fact that Antonin Scalia died over the weekend and now the court is split evenly 4-4 and a decision might be difficult to arrive at?
Well, I think they were already sort of hampered by the deadlines that the three judges set.
Yep, you know? That's exactly.
And the fact that the primary is coming up really quickly. It's looming large.
Yeah.
That's Eric Frazier with the Charlotte Observer. Mary Newsom's here from the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. Tom Bullock from WFAE News and Hillary Burns from the Charlotte Business Journal. We take a break. We're coming back with more on that and the South Carolina primary, which is tomorrow, coming up on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Actors Theater of Charlotte, presenting Father Comes Home from the Wars now through March 12th. The Civil War drama by Susan Laurie Parks follows a slave to the Confederate battlefield. More info at atcharlotte.org. Well, as the GOP presidential campaign passes through the buckle of the Bible Belt, Donald Trump is expected to notch a win with the help of an unlikely constituency, evangelical voters. They are apparently willing to look past what some see as Trump's sometimes crude, often rude comments and behavior. The question is, why are they doing this, and how has the mainly Southern group embraced this brash northerner. We take a closer look at that and more on Monday on this program at 9. If you'd like to comment or ask questions about what we're talking about this morning on our roundtable of reporters, you can reach us at WFAE through Facebook or Twitter, or charlottetalks@wfae.org, and we're coming right back.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Apple fights a court order to unlock the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters. President Obama and Republicans battle over the Supreme Court vacancy. And presidential hopefuls woo voters in South Carolina and Nevada.
The Diane Rehm Show and the News Roundup from 10 to noon right after the Charlotte Talks News Roundup here on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's our regional weekly news roundup on Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins with Tom Bullock, Mary Newsom, Eric Frazier, Hillary Burns. We also have a new Twitter handle. We have retrieved our Charlotte Talks, at Charlotte Talks Twitter handle, so you can get to us through that as well. Before we move on to other things, as you mentioned, I think, Tom, the way the boundaries in the congressional districts have been currently drawn, that was approved by the Barack Obama Justice Department. Mm-hmm. They looked at it and said, okay, now this three-judge panel has said no. Mm-hmm. But the panel is not really part of – they're not political, and they're not part of the – well, they are political probably, but they're not supposed to be, and they're not part of the Justice Department. So is this a
surprise?
Well,
no. I mean it still falls under the judiciary. I don't want to make it sound like
But aren't they independent of what
they're – Yeah, they're not officially in the Justice Department. They weren't under the purview of Eric Holder. That is correct.
So what does this do for voters? I mean, do voters – they'll be affected by it at the polling place. Surely they've heard about it. Do you think they feel confused about it, or do you think they'll be able to make intelligent decisions?
I have to think that voters are extremely confused by this, because you've got basically two – you've got – we're preparing for two different elections at one time and not knowing at this point which one will actually happen. And we won't know, I guess, until right before the primary. Yeah. And whether or not the Supreme Court actually issues a stay or overturns the current maps.
I mean, think about it this way. You will literally see in some districts television ads or stump speeches from one congressional candidate before the March 15th primary, who may or may not end up running for Congress on the June 7th primary. And or you may see a different person come in. Confusion is almost guaranteed. I'm a political reporter, and I'm confused looking at some of this stuff because it's very significant.
And part of the redistricting that has been confusing to people for the last 10 years is that they have begun more and more to split precincts. If you're in one precinct, two people in one precinct may or may not be in the same. I know the state House and Senate districts are split. I think some of the congressional districts also split precincts.
So printing the ballots, or even doing the electronic version of the ballots, becomes Byzantine. It's really complicated because, as you say, in the same precinct, you may have different people voting for different candidates.
Yes.
I actually talked with Josh Lawson, the general counsel for the North Carolina State Board of Elections, to go through with him what all of these changes would actually mean. There are roughly 4,500 different styles of ballots that need to be printed and reprinted because of this. There's this fascinating thing called geolocating all of the voters, which means the local boards of elections for the counties have to go through and figure out which precinct each voter now belongs in, and it is a huge undertaking. And then you've got a second election now, which means the county boards of elections also have to spend money to go and rent locations for early voting and precincts and poll workers and all that stuff. It's not as easy as just changing a date on a calendar. There is a huge logistical pileup that this causes.
Well, I was listening to the General Assembly yesterday debating all this, and at one point they said that it would cost $9 million,
That's exactly right.
An election.
That's an estimate, too, based on 2014. It may be higher. Mm-hmm.
Is this an argument for coming up with some sort of a commission, a nonpartisan commission, to draw these districts every 10 years as a result of the census in the first place?
Senator Jeff Jackson from Mecklenburg County made an impassioned plea for exactly that yesterday during all of this debate in Raleigh. And he basically was at one point he told the lawmakers that this is the time, this is all this confusion, this is the moment where you can finally end all this madness with partisan redistricting. And
they rallied around him, right?
And at one point, they almost gaveled him out of order based on the video I was watching. And there was this big sort of round of laughter over that.
And I just want to throw in on this, the proposed commission would not be nonpartisan. It would be bipartisan. I don't think it can be nonpartisan.
Unless you bring in somebody from North Dakota to draw the lines here, and we'll draw theirs for them. Let's move on to an election that we know a little more about, at least in terms of certainty. It's happening tomorrow, no question, the GOP primary in South Carolina. And a new nemesis has entered the race, the Pope.
I think all the candidates except Donald Trump would not consider him a nemesis.
Well, before we talk about the Pope and Donald Trump, let's talk about really the tenor of this got kicked off last Saturday at the Republican debate in Greenville. It was a knockdown, dragout, free-for-all. I've never seen anything like this in my life, I don't think.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, honestly, there was the one moment that really stuck in my head is when the moderator literally tried to yell over candidates yelling over each other, and they resorted to, "Gentlemen, you must stop or I will turn this car around." That was actually said on national television. And they didn't stop, so apparently the debate was turned around.
This really is boiling down to, as I understand it, a battle for the makeup of and the ongoing existence of the Republican Party as we know it, isn't it?
I think that's exactly correct. I think you've got a situation where the base of the Republican Party is not buying what the traditional leadership of the Republican Party is selling. And poor Jeb Bush is sort of the embodiment of that. He's got all the money, all the endorsements, everything. He won the shadow primary, and he's getting trounced.
I have a theory about this, and I'd like to hear your opinion of this theory. I think the Republican Party is being hoisted by its own petard. I think that they have unleashed they were very happy to have people like Rush Limbaugh and Fox News and Michael Savage and other people come out on the media and pound the drum relentlessly for the conservative message, and now they're not conservative enough, for these guys have power now.
Yeah.
And I think they've been hoisted by their own petard.
I think there's a lot to be said for that viewpoint. I think you see a lot of people in the Republican establishment trying to use the term conservative and saying that Donald Trump is not conservative enough. Mm-hmm. He's not a true conservative, as if this is sort of the get in to the club card that you need to, you know, present at the door. And the voters don't really seem to care.
Right.
They want someone very strong, very tough, who will, you know, they feel like everything, their way of life, everything they believe in, that their values are being run over by the Barack Obama era, and they want somebody to stand up and start swinging.
And I believe to a great
Donald Trump does, and they don't really care about the rest.
I believe to a great degree they believe that because they hear it every day on the radio and on television. South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley has been rumored to be a vice presidential possibility in the Republican Party, but yesterday she endorsed Marco Rubio. If Donald Trump walks away with the nomination, she's not going to become the vice president.
She never was anyway. I mean, after her very well-received Republican response to President Obama's State of the Union address, she directly, although not saying his name, she directly called out Trump and the anger vote. She didn't have to worry about that. But that doesn't.
That's smart to do in a political year where the anger vote seems to be the loudest voice and the one controlling who's winning these contests.
I don't think we'll know the answer to that until November. But it is interesting that she, whether it was not smart or whether it was brave, we'll know soon enough. But she also still had a pretty important pick. She was getting courted. Her endorsement was getting courted by the Ted Cruz camp, by the Jeb Bush camp, you know, I'm sure by the John Kasich camp, and obviously by the Marco Rubio camp, where she eventually went.
What does it say about the Bush camp that she endorsed Marco Rubio? Hillary.
Well, one thing I've been watching, I think it was your story, Tom, about Jeb Bush's super PAC and how the money now is, they spent so much, and now the advertising isn't really paying off. And he's moving more towards Ted Cruz's plan of using canvassers out on the street, going door to door. And it's not really working well for Jeb Bush. And he doesn't have being a millennial, he doesn't have any millennial support, I would say. He's not connecting well, and here we are. We'll see how it goes tomorrow for him.
Yeah, I also think Nikki Haley was elected by the Tea Party, and sometimes you got to dance with who brung you, and Jeb is just not aligned with the Tea Party.
But Donald Trump certainly is.
Well,
Donald Trump sort of straddles so many lines.
Yeah, he's more of I know this sounds funny. He's more of a coalition builder.
It's the Trump Party.
It's the Trump Party. I mean, realistically, it really is. You know, with Nikki Haley, though, it's funny to me because you're right, Mary. She was elected as a Tea Party candidate. She was not expected to do well, and she won. Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz, all pretty much along that same wave. But if you look at the way everybody's breaking down now, you know, Governor Haley is being seen as basically kind of a mainstream standard bearer. Marco Rubio is positioning himself to be the mainstream candidate. It kind of goes back to a bit of what you were talking about before, Mike. It's, you know, the civil war in the Republican Party is still being fought, and everybody's still waiting to see which faction becomes dominant.
Well, you ran this story this morning just before we came on the air about the Super PAC Right to Rise, which was created, as you said, with the sole intention of electing Jeb Bush president, and they raised $120 million last year. But so far, that money has done nothing but go to radio and television stations, and it's done nothing for the Jeb Bush candidacy. Does this spell the end of super PACs? Because people will suddenly realize that Bernie Sanders collecting all this money from individual donors and Donald Trump spending his own vast fortune are far more influential and powerful.
Well, I don't think anything is going to spell the end of the super PACs until something is actually done that makes that concept, you know, it's not palatable anymore or it's illegal. I mean, the reality is Right to Rise – Everybody thought they were going to redefine big money politics. They were going to write the new playbook. They haven't. I mean, you know, Jeb Bush just has not caught fire, and they have spent a huge amount of money. But, you know, Ted Cruz has quite a few super PACs that are raising money for him and spending money for him. I think the fiasco, and I think it's fair in some circles to call it a fiasco, of Right to Rise spending all that money for so few votes just means that people are going to have to stop and consider where is the best place to put money. I mean, attack ads don't always work, but sometimes they do. Pro ads don't always work, but sometimes they do. I think right now the media landscape for political candidates is in as much flux as every other media landscape out there.
And just when you thought it couldn't get any stranger than it already has gotten, yesterday the Pope entered the race. He was asked on an airplane coming back, I guess, from Mexico what he thought about Donald Trump's idea of building a wall separating the U.S. from Mexico. And he said that anybody who builds wall – I'm paraphrasing here – anybody who builds walls instead of bridges is not – Christian. Within moments, Donald Trump had a prepared statement, and he basically said, it's disgraceful for a religious leader to question a person's faith. My first thought was, who better?
Yeah, really.
Who better? But aside from all this volley of words, will it hurt him with the religious right? Because this is, after all, the Pope. And evangelicals, by and large, although there are evangelical Catholics, are not Catholic.
But South Carolina has traditionally had very, very few Catholics. It's changed in recent years. And I think North Carolina has been the same.
But it's not even a wake-up call for evangelicals when a man who is considered to be a holy man says, you know, maybe this is not a Christian idea.
I think they already know that Donald Trump has problems on the faith sector, on the faith front. You know, I don't think they really care.
And Baptists and Catholics are not the closest of religious allies.
No. Yeah, I think anything that Donald Trump does that portrays strength and him standing up to, of all people, the Pope, that if that doesn't portray strength, you know, nothing does. I think anything he does along those lines helps him.
I agree with that. I mean, part of his fan following, they're watching his every move and looking forward to the next statement that he'll make that's just as ridiculous or more so than the last. It was almost expected that he had that statement ready to go.
Mm-hmm. Wow. And I mean, just to build off on what Hillary was just saying, it also brings to the fact that Donald Trump, whose candidacy was once seen as like a sideshow, is now such a prominent political figure in America that he's getting comments from the Pope, which doesn't happen every day.
So we talked about a little bit about Jeb Bush. We've talked about Marco Rubio a little bit, certainly Donald Trump a lot. What about Ted Cruz? What about John Kasich? How will they fare tomorrow in South Carolina?
Well, Cruz, I think, is the good question there. I think if he comes in a strong second, that will propel him forward, with some good momentum. But I think he and Rubio, and you see all this sniping between the two of them, they both realize that, you know, the sort of media messaging out of South Carolina will be whoever comes in second gets, you know, sort of most of that positive buzz because, you know, everybody's, you know, it's kind of a fait accompli that Trump is going to come in number one. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of a battle for the positioning of media messaging going out of South Carolina.
Will we, as we did in New Hampshire, will we see an exit from this campaign?
I think this is Bush's last stand.
If not, he runs the risk of being, you know, the classic zombie candidate. Also, we should remember that Ben Carson is still in the race. He may have already crossed into that zombie threshold where you continue on, although your chances are slim to none. What I'm going to watch with the Ted Cruz results is, and it goes back to, it seems like everything these days goes back to Donald Trump. Donald Trump is doing incredibly well with evangelicals. Ted Cruz, you need to watch how he does. If he loses the evangelical vote to Donald Trump, it's hard to see where Ted Cruz can go to secure a nomination. That is the base he is playing to.
We talked a little bit about this on Tuesday night at our South Carolina primary show at Winthrop University, and that is the fact that evangelicals who have supported a lot of candidates on the right have been perpetually disappointed. Once those candidates take office, they make promises to garner the vote. They vote for that person. They get into office. They don't do anything that they've said they will do for the evangelicals. And now what we were saying, I think, on Tuesday night was that these people are now looking at other alternatives, not just people on the religious right, but other people who they hear speaking their message in hopes that they will follow through. Is this a last stand for evangelicals? For instance, if Donald Trump wins and doesn't do for the evangelicals what they think he will do, where do they turn next?
I think there's a real question about whether or not the evangelicals and the Tea Party will, as a result of this election, if they don't get what they hope for. Mm-hmm. I personally could easily see a splintering of the Republican Party.
And what would that mean? Because America's not set up for three
parties.
That's
a good question. That's a good question. I mean, there have been points in the past where we have had. But not long.
The Bull Moose Party comes to mind. The Know Nothing Party comes to mind.
Yeah, the Reform Party. I think there was a conservative party at one point. Yeah.
We're going to talk about the Democrats more fully next week prior to their primary in the Palmetto State. But where does it stand right now in South Carolina between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders?
Well, Hillary still has a lead in the polls, and it's looking like she's about to get the biggest endorsement in South Carolina Democratic politics, which is Jim Clyburn. That's huge. He actually stayed out of 2008. He didn't endorse either Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton. And the Clinton campaign it's looking like they're really going to need South Carolina, not just as a win, but a big one, because the Nevada caucus is
It's neck and neck.
It's neck and neck, but it's also not going to have a huge turnout. It's a caucus on a Saturday. It's still relatively new. But if Bernie Sanders starts showing he can win with minority voters, that's going to hurt Clinton.
That's the other thing. All these things on Saturday, these elections on Saturday, they say we can't have a general election on Saturday. You have to have it on Tuesday. People can go into the polls on Saturday and vote. Maybe they're sending a message here. We have to take a break. We'll come back with more and talk about marijuana when we come back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and New Oasis International Education, striving to open the world to Charlotte, one student and family at a time, now accepting host families for international students. Details available at newoasisedu.com. And Highland Avenue Restaurant in Hickory, North Carolina, hosting the annual Kyle and Friends Chef Dinner, March 28th, with cuisine from 30 Southeastern chefs, brewers, distillers, and winemakers. HighlandAvenueRestaurants.com. Apple fights a court order to unlock the iPhone of one of the San Bernardino shooters. President Obama and Republicans battle over the Supreme Court vacancy, and presidential hopefuls woo voters just south of us and in Nevada. That's just some of the stories coming up on the weekly news roundup. The international, the the National Hour first at 10 o'clock, the International Hour at 11 on The Diane Rehm Show, and we will continue with our regional roundup in just a moment.
With the feds watching, you got to dot every I and cross every T.
This store, Westside Armory, they will not sell a gun and let it go out onto the street until the background check has been resolved.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, 3 days behind the counter at a gun shop. Next time on Marketplace.
Marketplace this evening at 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE. Listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's our regional weekly news roundup in advance of Diane's national and international hours at 10 and 11. Tom Bullock is with us from WFAE News. Mary Newsom, the Associate Director of the UNC Charlotte Urban Institute. Eric Frazier, Editorial Writer for the Charlotte Observer. And Hillary Burns, Senior Staff Writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. We have one comment about elections before we move on from Cameron. On Facebook, one of your guests says that there is no Democrat running for Pittenger's seat. There is a filed Democrat named Christian Cano, C-A-N-O. Any comment on that?
Thank you for the correction.
Okay. If you'd like to reach us, you can do so through Facebook or Twitter at Charlotte Talks or Facebook at WFAE, or you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. I'm not sure how we're going to talk about this next segment because nobody wants to exhale. This week, The Observer reported on big racial disparities in marijuana arrests by the Charlotte-Mecklenburg Police Department. What did you find, Eric?
Basically, our reporter, Steve Harrison, who crunched the numbers, found that over the past 2 years, when it comes to low-level marijuana arrests under half an ounce, I think was his data point, 26% of African Americans who get stopped for that get arrested. 9% of whites who get stopped for that get arrested. Big disparity, and one that there are questions about why that happens when, you know, usage rates are about the same.
Well, the paper asserted that there might be a good explanation for the disparity that that had little to do with race. Did you find any way to explain that away other than race?
Well, the only explanation has been anecdotal, more or less, from the chief of police, Kurt Putney, who said that one explanation might be that you have more calls for service regarding people on the corners or people on the streets from African-American communities, and therefore officers are responding to a request for service from, you know, from someone who's concerned, and they sort of perhaps feel like they should make an arrest just to sort of show the person who called, the concerned citizen, that we're responding, we're taking action. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's one explanation. But I think it's still kind of an open question as to whether or not that all the statistics, if you could get all the statistics in hand, if that would all, you know, if that would be what the statistics show. And that's a question that I have and that I think the city council needs to answer, and the mayor. And Jennifer Roberts, the mayor, she has said that she's troubled by this and that she's going to be talking more with the chief about it. But I think if they can sort of reduce this question to data, mm-hmm. so that people can definitively see whether or not when you control for the geography and the crime rates, whether or not you still have the disparity, even, you know, despite controlling for those factors, then I think that would go a long way towards answering this question.
Why did the paper look into this in the first place?
That's actually a better question for the reporter.
Steve's idea? Did he enterprise the story?
But I think one of the reasons why is that this is the whole question of marijuana, you know, usage and marijuana arrests and legalization of marijuana, decriminalizing marijuana is a national issue. And there have been people in Charlotte here locally who've been pressing the city council, not with much success, to decriminalize marijuana.
And yet,
so this is it's a good question to be taking.
I think this was in the story. I think this is where I got this. Despite changing attitudes around the country about marijuana, this is still kind of a political hot potato in North Carolina, and that the state legislature has said if the city council acts to decriminalize, they'll step in.
Well, it wouldn't obviously be the first time the state legislature has done that. They've shown a willingness to do that. I mean, you know, on the non-discrimination ordinance, I think that city council is going to take up next week. There's a fear among city council members that the state will come behind them and, you know, sort of try to pass a law blocking, you know, what they want to do there. So, yeah, it is an open question about what the state would do. But currently, the city council does not have a policy about what an officer should or shouldn't do when they are confronted with a person who, you know, is holding less than an ounce of marijuana.
That seems to be an ongoing problem at CMPD, where there was another issue recently that had to deal with that wasn't a policy for how an mm-hmm. officer should act. So they're pretty much out there in the field on their own making a decision. Will this investigation spur the development of a policy?
That's a good question. I think that that's something that the city council members should give a lot of thought to. I think in Charlotte, there's been traditionally on city council the feeling that you should give the police chief sort of wide range to mm-hmm. kind of enforce, you know, laws and handle the enforcement and the practical nuts and bolts of enforcement the way that they see fit. But there are some cases, I think, when the city council needs to have a voice on
did
that.
Kerr Putney,
and this may be one of them.
Did Kerr Putney say anything about looking into this and developing a policy? I know he did make a statement at the paper, which you've already alluded to, but did he talk about what happens next?
He did not, to my knowledge, no.
The CMS student assignment plans are still just that, in the planning stage. But there was a meeting on Tuesday night at Carmel Baptist Church in Matthews, to which about 1,000 people came. That's a lot. That's a big turnout. School board member Paul Bailey got applause from the crowd when he mentioned his support for neighborhood schools. Is that something only people in the suburbs want? Or could that same applause occur with that statement in the urban setting?
I think it depends on what your quote-unquote neighborhood school is like. And let's back up a little bit and be clear that the term neighborhood school, I mean, we're not talking kids walking down the block to schools.
They're still on a bus.
Almost all kids are on a bus. Kids who want to walk to school sometimes are told they are forbidden from doing that, although I hope that's changing. But they're talking schools that are kind of in your neck of the woods as opposed to quote-unquote neighborhood schools. And if your neck of the woods is a comparatively affluent neck of the woods, you don't necessarily want your kids going to school with those students from over there.
And you wrote an editorial in the paper, Eric, which was headlined, "Concerns Over Possible Forced Busing Are Swirling." Again, only in the suburbs or in the urban schools as well?
Mostly in the suburbs, but there are people in the inner city who are also concerned because they feel like in the past their children have borne the brunt of the mileage when it comes to being bused.
We bus now, so what's the real concern here? What is forced busing?
Well, it's a loaded code word, and I don't think anybody really has a definitive definition of at what point are you being bused. Is it 5 miles? Is it 1 mile? Is it 10 mile? But it's sort of the substitute for, you know, how both racial and socioeconomic integration, how much is too much, mm-hmm. at what point does your school tip over and become somewhere that your child will feel, you know, uncomfortable with. And people are, you know, and you, understandably in some way, people are inclined to be very passionate about that and to try to err on the side of caution, mm-hmm. even though I think everybody's impulse is that integration is good. When it gets down to the brass tacks of in making that happen in a city that geographically is not very well integrated, that's when you start getting the
tensions. And I think the use of the term forced busing, if you think about it, it's like a relic Because, in fact, if you go to a public school in Charlotte-Mecklenburg, you are assigned to a school, or you go to a magnet school, and you are not forced to take the bus, although if you need the bus, you take it, but you are forced to go to that school. The term forced busing, you know, basically alludes to the 70s, which was forced integration.
Right.
Because you still had to take the bus to the school you were assigned to. I think it's a code word for more integrated schools.
Yeah.
You suggested
it is a substitute for forced integration.
You suggested
That's really what we're talking about.
In your editorial, Eric, you suggested that the board needs to clarify that its real concern is breaking up clusters of poverty. Hasn't that been clarified?
Well, they've said that that is one of the things that they are concerned about. They have not said, because on the surface, and if someone can explain it to me otherwise, I would welcome that explanation. But it seems like, on the one hand, you have preserving neighborhood schools. On the other hand, you have bringing more integration and more diversity in a neighborhood, in a city that where the neighborhoods are not well integrated. Mm-hmm. Those two things can't 100% happen at the same time. So one has to be a priority or the other. And we were basically telling the school board, you cannot walk away from our historic drive towards trying to keep some level of socioeconomic and or racial integration in the schools.
And you also wrote that this problem of 1 in 3 CMS campuses being segregated by poverty and half segregated by race, and the fact that the number of high minority, high poverty schools in CMS is now over 40%. That threatens, and I quote here, the viability of the entire school district and of Charlotte as a city.
Sure.
Wow. How so?
Yeah, it does. I mean, we've seen this happen in other cities all across the country. I mean, Detroit being sort of the blinking red light that everybody always points to, where you have the flight to the suburbs, and the next thing you have is the folks in the suburbs trying to establish their own school systems, which you hear already, you've heard for years here in Charlotte. And the thing that Charlotte has made Charlotte unique and that has kept Charlotte from going down that road has been the fact that we have a countywide school system in which all of the resources of the broader metropolitan area are shared throughout that broader metropolitan area rather than suburban schools here, urban schools there, struggling, you know, without the tax base.
Mary, you're with the Urban Institute. Do you think people understand all this, or are they really being very parochial about their outlook on this? They want their kid in the school that they want them in, and they don't want them taking a long bus ride. They don't care about the pockets of poverty.
I think people are more diverse than that. You've sketched out some attitudes that some people probably have. I think other people are more I think with other people it's more nuanced. And I also think that when it's your own kid, you get crazy mm-hmm. in a way that you don't get crazy when it's not your own kid, when it's kind of theoretical kids and for the good of the community. But if it's your kid and you're thinking, oh, my goodness, my kid's going to be going to school with kids who are carrying guns, you get worried. Now, who is carrying guns? Well, as near as I tell, everybody in the country is now carrying guns.
Really.
That was a joke. You don't really want them in your schools, and they are not really in the schools. But I think that people I was actually looking at this redistricting map sitting in front of me and thinking that drawing attendance lines is a bit like redistricting, that you try to take into account all kinds of different factors, economics, race, you know, bus routes. It's actually difficult. And you've got a growing population. People are flooding into the city. You're going to have to change the lines, or you're going to have some schools that are bursting at the seams and other schools that are underused. You got to even that out. That is fraught, even when you don't add race and income to it.
The whole nation has been following the problems in Flint, Michigan, with lead in the drinking water there, and now there may be a problem in York County. Carolina Water Service tested 52 of its 105 water systems in the state of South Carolina. Three returned results showing elevated levels of lead. The River Hill system and Foxwood in Fort Mill, and then Cedarwood in Lexington County, which is near Columbia. Did they discover high lead levels in the course of normal testing, or were they looking at it or looking for it for some reason?
I don't know the answer to that, but my guess is it was normal testing. And one thing that people—
How high were these levels, and how do they compare to what's going on in Flint?
I think the Flint comparison is a little bit flawed, with this one exception, which is that lead in drinking water doesn't always come from the water supply itself. It can come from the pipes in your house, and I think that's part of what the problem has been in Flint. This is a private water system. It is not a publicly owned utility. Private water systems have had their own history of problems over the years. I think the town of Tigaque took over their water system because of similar problems. This company says they tested again and they didn't find any lead. They're going to do continuing testing. I think at this point we don't know. The headline is there's a lot of lead in a lot of water systems in the U.S., not just Flint.
Okay. Speaking of lead, lead's heavy, it falls to the bottom. And speaking of falling to the bottom, there's a new report that finds local executives have pessimistic outlooks for the U.S. economy. And the Business Journal, you, Hillary, reported on this, in fact. And what are these executives saying?
Well, the study was actually a national study, and then Deloitte partnered with the Business Journals to localize it. So when I looked at the numbers for Charlotte, mid-market executives here are a bit more pessimistic than national averages, but they're pessimistic about the U.S. economy. They don't think it's growing at the rate it has been in the recent past. But the good news is that businesses here in Charlotte are planning to hire at a higher average than nationally.
Despite their pessimism.
Despite their pessimism about the national economy, they feel good about their own businesses. They are planning to add staff in the next year. They are optimistic about their own businesses. They just don't have a great view of the national economy. And they think that it's slowing. It's not coming to a halt. It's just a bit more pessimistic.
The light rail hit a milestone this week by building a bridge over Harris Boulevard. Is that an indication that this project is on track?
As far as I know, it's on track. We want it fast. At UNC Charlotte.
And I do have to point out the great pun you just did there without an accent.
Yes, I did. I didn't even mention it. I'm glad you picked up on it. It shows you that you're bright. Tom Bullock is a reporter for WFAE News. Mary Newsom, Associate Director for UNC Charlotte's Urban Institute. Eric Frazier, Editorial Writer for the Charlotte Observer. And Hillary Burns, Staff Writer for the Charlotte Business Journal. The national hour of the News Roundup is next, with the Diane Rehm Show. Thanks for the hour, guys.
Charlotte Talks with Mike.